are doing urine cultures this week. And there's my dancing leprechaun.
Got a what?
Isn't that a leprechaun?
Sure, I think so.
Don't we have leprechaun day coming up?
Next Wednesday.
Okay, just to get you in the mood. See, we're having fun already. Okay, let's go over a review of the anatomy of the urinary system. It includes four organs, which are the kidney, the ureter, which is the tube that drains the urine from the kidney, third organ is the bladder, and fourth organ is the urethra that drains the urine from the bladder to the outside. So we can have problems in any one of those areas, kidney, ureter, bladder, or urethra, and have abnormalities, or especially if it's an infection, have organisms show up in the urine sample. Mostly, we get urine samples because of bladder infections, but again, it could be any one of those areas. Now, is the urine a sterile fluid? It is sterile. It is sterile above the urethra. Okay? After it passes, well, the urethra is actually pretty sterile too, but it's a short opening, so as soon as it passes through there, there can be contamination from the surrounding skin area. So the sample needs to be collected appropriately to minimize the amount of normal flora or contaminating organisms that we get in there. Okay, there's different types of collection, specimen collection that we can obtain. Most common is clean catch. There's clean catch, catheter, suprapubic, and bag. We'll go through each one of these. So the most common is the clean catch method. It's best if we can get a first morning sample because the urine has been allowed to incubate in the bladder overnight. It's a little bit more concentrated, and we're more likely to find organisms and other abnormalities in a first morning. But we can accept a random one. If the patient happens to have an appointment later in the afternoon, it's not a good idea for the patient to collect the sample and leave it sitting around at home, bring it in, that kind of thing. So it's best if we can't get a first morning one to get a random one. But at least should be a midstream clean catch. What does midstream mean? Okay, you usually void at least probably the first 15 milliliters, throw that away, discard that away, and then collect the remaining urine. And we don't need very much. We only need a test tube full, 15 milliliters. We don't need a whole quart. It's one of the problems that people collect it at home. So that minimizes, the midstream minimizes some of the organisms that might be in the outer part of the urethra. Clean catch means that we need to cleanse the opening to the urinary tract. So you usually give the patient comes into the doctor, or the patient goes into the hospital, the emergency room, or whatever, there should be a collection kit that is given to the patient. It should contain some gauze squares or cotton balls, some kind of soap or antiseptic solution. And oftentimes, they give a little paper or a little card in there that has some stick figure diagrams about how to collect the sample. So the information should be given verbally to the patient because the patient doesn't know how to do this stuff, how to collect the sample. The information should be given verbally to the patient, and then also it should be, whether it is or not, I don't know, but it should be a figure in case they don't speak English or something like that, so they know how to collect the sample, because we cannot collect the sample for them unless we do one of these others. So there's the diagram. Cleanse the outside area with the soap, the gauze squares, cotton balls, whatever. Get rid of as much normal flora as possible so that we can get a good sample. And then it should be, if it's collected for culture, it should be collected in a sterile container and sent to the lab. We'll talk about transport and what we do with it later. Okay, so that's what we mostly get then. Second method of collection is the catheterized sample. One thing you don't want to do, unless you absolutely have to, is have a catheter. And the reason is because it's not particularly a pleasant situation, but also the risk of introducing organisms into the urethral or the urinary tract causing infections. Okay, they used to have, we started out with wooden catheters, actually.
Oh my gosh.
this was when When Shauna was practicing the
mass.
They used the wooden counter. And then they went to other types of materials, and now they have pretty much these nice, flexible plastic-type catheters. They're short, and they can be readily inserted, and they can do it very quickly, especially if you're in the ER. They can insert those very quickly, just get a sufficient amount of urine, and send that to the lab. That's a single-dwelling catheter. So there are two types of catheters. There's a single-dwelling, which is just insert the catheter once and get the sample. And then there's the long-term catheterization, or the indwelling catheterization, where the patient usually is in the hospital and has to have a catheter in place for several days, depending upon what their situation is. There's usually some kind of a retention balloon on the end so that it holds it in place. And then when we collect that sample, we usually puncture the catheter tube with a needle and withdraw the urine from the tube. You don't want to take it from the collection bag because the urine may have been in there for a period of time, and that's no good. And under no circumstances do you want to take a urine sample from a urinal or a bedpan. Okay, so again, a lot of information, and oftentimes it's not the laboratory that collects this, so that information has to be conveyed from the laboratory to the nursing staff, if it's somewhere on the floor or emergency room or whatever, so that we get a good sample. Because remember, garbage in, garbage out. Okay, here's a bladder catheterization. We just simply insert the catheter through the urethra into the bladder, and that's the most common type that we use. But it is possible to do, that's called urethral catheterization, it is possible to do ureteric catheterization. So this would be done primarily if the patient does have a kidney infection, which is much more severe than just a bladder infection. And they don't know which kidney is involved, so if they want to know which kidney is the one that's diseased, they can stick the catheter up into the ureter on the right side or the left side and withdraw urine that way, and that can better tell them which kidney is involved. So that's a possibility. Okay, suprapubic aspiration. In the event that it's not possible to obtain a midstream clean catch or catheter, suprapubic is a possibility. So the patient usually has to consume sufficient fluids and then not urinate for at least a couple hours afterwards to allow the fluid to accumulate in the bladder, because it takes a period of time to get through there into the bladder. Patient is draped. The area just above the pubic bone is cleansed scrupulously, and then they're draped. There's a little opening. Usually the physician does this, and they use a syringe, probably about a 20-mil syringe, and they just boink, just poke it in, and it usually goes straight through into the bladder.
I cannot think of one reason why you would have to do this. I mean, if their bladder is full, are they retarded? Like, why can't they catch them?
Sometimes there's an obstruction. Urinary obstruction, like a stone or something like that. They can't come out. Or if they're particularly looking for anaerobes, this is the best sample collection to get for an anaerobe. And sometimes anaerobes cause urinary tract infections.
I've heard it before also for trauma.
Yeah, trauma patients.
Their trauma is severe enough that they just can't get it in otherwise.
They've come in a severe auto accident or something of that sort. And so there are reasons. Again, this is not the most common one, and certainly if they can get it the other way, they will do that. But it's another alternative. So this is a sterile. This should be a sterile sample. There's no contamination here because it does not pass through the urethra, so there's no contamination. And then there's the bag specimen. It's pretty easy on little boys, but they can still do it on little girls too. They just attach a bag and wait till they urinate and collect it. So you just have to follow them around and get the sample. So you want to collect it or get the bag as soon as possible, so it's not contaminated with fecal contamination or whatever. But that's a possibility too. Okay, so then, what do we do with the sample? We need to culture it within at least 2 hours. You don't want to let it sit around for more than 2 hours. And the reason is because if there are a few contaminating organisms in there from the skin or the vaginal area in females, it's much easier to get some kind of contamination from females, or much more common, I should say, than it is in males. They're going to proliferate too, and that's going to mess up the whole picture. So we need to get it. It can't be sitting around at the nursing station or in the physician's office on the countertop. We need to get it to the lab and culture within 2 hours. Now, if it can't be cultured within 2 hours, then we can refrigerate it. And refrigeration, cold temperatures, 4 degrees centigrade, will retard the growth of the organisms for 24 hours. You don't want to leave it in there for longer than that, but 24-hour refrigeration is okay. Yes?
Does pH change with time?
Yes, it will, especially at room temperature, because the organisms are metabolizing, they're producing alkaline products, so the pH will change. And that, in turn, will cause deterioration of some of the white cells and casts and other elements that are in there. So that's another reason why you don't want to leave it at room temperature. If it's collected in a physician office or if it needs to be transported to a reference lab, for example, then there are transport systems. There are tubes in which you put 3 milliliters of urine and there's a little preservative already in there. Maybe it's a little tablet or something that dissolves. And that preserves the urine usually for up to 72 hours so that it can be transported by mail or courier or whatever to a laboratory that's going to analyze it. But that's not something we do. If we can get it to the lab immediately, or once the lab gets it, they can refrigerate it. We won't use the preservative. Okay, and then finally, we only want one specimen per day. The lab does not want to be inundated with urine samples from the same patient on the same day. That doesn't really tell us anything. So if we don't isolate something within a couple days, the doc wants to send in another sample, that's okay, but not on the same day. Okay, this is in your textbook. We'll just go over a few of the organisms that might be there as normal flora. The newborn is sterile at birth, but it doesn't take long, 24 hours to 3 days, for normal flora to start colonizing the area. And again, particularly it's the outer opening of the urethra. The rest of the urinary tract is sterile unless there's an infection. So, staph. What kind of staph would you suppose? Epidermidis. Enterococci. Diphtheroids. Those are the most common normal flora. Then we start getting into some lactobacillus, which are gram-positive rods, long, narrow gram-positive rods. We're actually going to study these in a couple weeks, so this is not a new one that we're introducing today. And you don't have to memorize all this stuff. Just kind of be most familiar with the most common ones that you're likely to experience. If we do get a streptococcus, it's most likely, what's alpha strep? What organisms are alpha strep? Viridins, right. It's most likely either strep viridins, which is normal flora, or gamma, which would be maybe perhaps the non-enterococci strep. You usually don't see beta strep in there, unless you might get a strep A galactia, but that's not really normal flora so much. What are coliforms? What? Coliforms, just a common name, a slang term for Enterobacteriaceae. Slang. Enterobacteriaceae, we just call them coliforms because they colonate the intestinal tract, the colon. Okay, adults might be, again, a little bit different, but don't memorize all of this stuff, just the most common ones. But it does change with age, and it does change with pregnancy, and there are some hormonal influences, particularly in the female. So we're going to go over yeast infections. Yeast are commonly causative agents of infections, but on occasion, particularly during pregnancy, they can be normal flora. Okay, these are, according to box 37.3, the most frequently isolated microbial agents of urinary tract infections. Not necessarily in this order, because really E. coli is probably the most common. But we can have enterococci, strep A galactia, particularly in females. Of the Enterobacteriaceae, E. coli is the most common, but you can see there's several of them that can cause it.
Are females more prone to getting UTIs?
Yes. Most of the urinary tract infections occur in females. And on Wednesday, we'll talk more about that type of thing and the actual symptoms and everything. Pseudomonas is a possibility. Now, these two, strep pyogenes and staph aureus, those are really quite uncommon as causative agents of urinary tract infections. You're just not likely to see a strep pyogenes in that anatomy, that part of the body anatomy. Not to say that it doesn't happen occasionally, or rarely, but not real common. Mostly Staph saprophyticus, if we see a staph. And the Candida species again, the yeast infections can be quite common. So on Wednesday we'll talk more about symptomology and that kind of thing. Less frequent, these, Gardnerella, ureaplasm, mycoplasma, hominis, mobiluncus, I should say, those are all causative agents of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, that can be in the urinary tract. So we're not going to talk about those at all this week. We'll cover those in a couple weeks. And then these associated with multi-system disease. Again, it's possible if they are really colonizing somewhere else and causing severe infections somewhere else in the body, it would not be unthinkable that they couldn't colonize the urinary tract, but not common. And ones that we're really not going to look for. We're going to look for the most common ones first. Okay. Oh, everybody wait. That looks like nice, warm, cozy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I have opened the... it was already open, but looked in my washer and there was a cat. Snooping around. Okay, so everybody wait, because here we go to the important stuff. Let me see the whites of your eyes. Okay, first thing we're going to do is a Gram stain. We do a Gram stain on uncentrifuged urine. We're looking for, when we do Gram stains, we're looking for organisms, and we're looking for white blood cells. Because if we find white blood cells in there, that's the best indication, aside from organisms, that we do have an infection. So if we see one or more organisms per field on Gram stain, this would be per oil immersion field, that is equivalent to 10 to the 5th colony-forming units or organisms per mil. So that's the sensitivity of the Gram stain. We've already talked about that. So in order to see organisms, we have to have at least 10 to the 5th organisms in there. If we see one or more white blood cells, that's indicative of pyuria, which just means pus in the urine or an infection. Now, we've talked about the acridine orange stain. What is acridine orange? What type of stain? It's a fluorescent stain. Okay, so most labs are not going to have these capabilities, as we've already talked about, and they're probably not going to use it for urine anyway. If they do have it, they'll use it for blood cultures, which we'll talk about next week. But it does have greater sensitivity. Yeah.
Do you check for contamination, too, with Gram stain? Like epithelial cells?
Yes, you look for epithelial cells, squamous epithelial cells. If you've got a lot of those, that may be an indication that you've got some contamination. Just skin contamination as the patient is avoiding and giving the urine sample. But we don't quantitate them. Okay, the media that we most routinely use, blood agar, MAC, and PEA. Ah, what's PEA? Phenylethyl alcohol, what's it used for? What? Nobody knows?
Gram-positive.
What? Cocci, gram-positive cocci. You remember PEA? It's selective for gram-positive cocci, mostly staphs and streps. What doesn't grow on there or is very inhibited then?
Gram-negative
rods, particularly the Enterobacteriaceae, the coliforms, which is what we're most likely to see in terms of gram-negative rods here. Okay. Some labs will use, instead of PEA, they'll use a CNA. I think we've mentioned this before, but we haven't used it. It stands for cholestanolytic acid, but it's pretty much the same use as PEA. So again, it is selective for gram-positive cocci. Now, what is noticeably missing from this that we've used pretty much in the past?
Chocolate.
Chocolate. Okay, what's chocolate primarily used for? What type of organism? Haemophilus? Neisseria. Okay. Those two types of organisms we are not likely to see in the urinary tract. unless we can see some especially pathogenic Neisseria gonorrhea, if there's a sexually transmitted disease, it might be in there. But other than that, they're not likely to be found there. So we're really not looking for those. That's why we don't need a chocolate. Okay, now, I need to see the whites of your eyes again. Okay, we plate this differently. Now, a few years ago, I went through this whole lecture, and then we went upstairs, and somebody just plated it the old regular way. Can you imagine?
Stunning.
Stunning, it was. Nobody in here would do that, I know. Okay, so we use a calibrated loop. Now, it just happens to be that the loops that you are using, the disposable loops, are calibrated loops. Before, when we did this, we would just use the wire loops, and they were not calibrated. But it has to be a calibrated loop. This is what we used to use. It was a combination loop. It had a big loop on one end, and so you see that tiny loop up there? Okay, so the one you're using now is just a single loop. It's this size. So we are going to be using that loop, and then we have another one, a separate one, that is this size. Okay? So you have to know the significance of that. The large loop, which is what we've been using, is calibrated to deliver 0.01 milliliters. And that's called the large loop. The small one is calibrated to deliver 0.001 milliliters. Okay, that's highly significant. Need to know. NTK. Need to know. All right. We can also do some chemical methods. We're going to get around to the plating technique here in just a minute. The chemical methods would be the dipstick. Now, you've all done a dipstick. The oldies did it last semester. The newies did it in 102. Yeah. Even Bill remembers how to do the dipstick. Okay. Sometimes, and it depends on the laboratory, sometimes your analyses are done in the chemistry department, sometimes they're done in the hematology department, wherever. So, but it's helpful to correlate the findings because there are two areas on the dipstick. These are two of the newer areas, the nitrite and the leukocyte esterase. And these are very helpful in determining whether or not we do have an infection or whether it's contamination. Nitrite detects bacteria in the urine. However, the bacteria must have been incubating in the bladder for at least 4 hours. So these are bacteria that will reduce nitrates. These are substances from our diet that get filtered to the kidney and appear in the bladder. The organism reduces the nitrate to nitrite. And that's why we need this 4-hour incubation time, and that's why the overnight sample or the first morning sample is the best sample. What do we say about one of the general characteristics of Enterobacteriaceae?
They're
oxidase negative, and I'm not sure if we emphasize this too much because we don't do it, but they reduce nitrates to nitrites. So the Enterobacteriaceae would then be nitrite positive. There are a few organisms, however, that do not reduce nitrate to nitrites. Enterococcus, I think, is one of them. So it is possible that you can still have significant growth or significant infection and have a negative nitrite. With a couple of those organisms that don't reduce nitrates, and also if the urine is not incubated in the bladder long enough time for the organism to convert it. Okay, leukocyte esterase detects white blood cells. Detects the enzyme in the white blood cells. If we have positive leukocyte esterase on the dipstick, that correlates with 6 or more white blood cells per high power field. When we do a microscopic urinalysis, we use a high power field. So this would be 6 organisms, which is generally considered abnormal. 0 to 5 is probably normal, so there's a few, we get a few in there, but greater than that would be a significant infection. So this is what we really want to correlate, is the presence of white blood cells in there with the organisms. Okay, here we go, the plating technique. Do I see the whites of your eyes again? Okay. All right, here we go. What you do is you get your urine sample, And it's usually in a collection cup. And we swirl around, make sure it's well mixed, because it may have been sitting for a couple hours, it may have been in the refrigerator overnight or whatever. So swirl around, make sure it's well mixed. You don't mix it with the loop. You gotta swirl it and get it mixed first. Then you take your loop and you dip it, you hold it vertical, straight up, dip it straight down. Don't swish it around, because that will affect how much fluid clings to the loop. So you just dip it down in the fluid, the urine sample, and then bring it back up. Okay? Then you take your loop, and you make one streak down the center of the plate. So we're going to do our SBA plate first. So we'll make one streak down the center, and then we go back, same loop, don't dip it again. Go back and spread this out. So we make these horizontal streaks. We're creating a lawn, like we did with Kirby Bauer or Mueller-Hinton. Only we do not retrace our steps. Do not retrace your steps. Just make close zigzag lines. I would do it even a little closer than this one. Just close zigzag lines. So we tend to get a nice lawn. That's how you spread the organisms out for urine samples. So do not go up and streak for isolation. Speak.
So we want to do it more like figure 2 than figure 1?
Yes. I did this. I tried to go over it with 10. But in some places, it might look like I was retracing my steps. But you do not want to retrace your steps. Just do the close zigzag lines.
On the whole plate.
On the whole plate, yeah. Do the whole plate. And then hopefully what you will get the next day is organisms that are spread out enough that you can count them. So what we're going to do is we're going to count the colonies. And the number of colonies that we get, the counting, helps us determine whether or not we have a significant infection or whether we just have contamination, whatever. So that's the purpose for spreading it out, because we need to quantify them. Okay, then you dip it again for your next plate, for the McConkie or the PEA, really doesn't matter which order you do those in. Dip it again and do the same thing for MAC and do the same thing for PEA, using the same size loop. Okay, the next day.
Sorry, can you switch loops out then, in case it gets...
Well, you can use the same loop.
Okay.
You don't have to use a different loop.
Okay.
Well, you can if you want to, but you don't have to.
All right. Then are we using the large side or the small side?
Well, I'm going to tell you. Okay. That's coming. Forthcoming. So let me see the whites of your eyes. Okay. If you use the small loop, because that is 0.001 milliliters... After we count our colonies the next day, we then have to multiply that count by 1,000, because that is 1,000th of a milliliter dilution that we use. So you have to know which size you use so that you can use the appropriate calculation factor. And that's how we report it. If you report to the physician 50 colonies, the doc has no idea what that means. So what should you report if you're using the small loop? 50,000. Yeah, 50,000 is what you report. Then the doc knows what you're doing. See, you're smarter than the doc. So make sure you use the appropriate dilution factor. Now, if you use the large loop, that's 0.01 milliliters, so you multiply the colonies by 100 instead of 1,000. So you see the difference it makes if you, which size loop you use? Usually, we use the small loop. Now, again, laboratories have different protocols, so some labs might use a larger loop for routine samples, but usually we use the smaller loop. So we're going to use the small size loop for our unknowns today. However, we're going to use the, well, I'll tell you, we'll get to that. Okay, so counting the colonies. Instead of averaging the growth on both plates, what I want you to do is just count the colonies on McConkie, if you have growth on McConkie, and report that using the appropriate calculation factor, and then count the colonies you have on PEA, and report that separately. So don't average them, just count them separately, MAC and PEA. Both organisms, if we have gram negatives and gram positives, they should both grow on blood, shouldn't they? So everything should be on blood. And sometimes they will count the colonies and just use what's on blood. But we're going to do MAC and PEA separately so that you can get used to calculating. So remember, if you use the small loop, you multiply by 1,000. That's, and we end up with then the organisms per milliliter. That's the way we report it, 50,000 organisms per milliliter or whatever. Okay, if we have greater than 100 colonies, and you will know when you look at your plates if you have greater than 100 colonies because they're kind of all jammed together. If we don't get them spread out nicely from the center line, they're all going to be growing right there on the center line, and you can't count them. But if you know you've got greater than 100, all you need to report is greater than 10 to the 5th organisms, assuming you use the small loop.
I'm sorry. So going back to counting the colonies, it's, I know that you said to count them separately, but average growth on both plates, do you originally average out the McConkie and PA, or the PEA together? Is that what you were saying?
Depends upon the lab.
And then,
but it's better if you separate. Well, good heavens, I have trouble with you. Usually, if it's a pure infection, you're only going to have one organism. Because if you collect the sample appropriately and there aren't contaminating organisms in there, if you do have an infection, then it's usually going to be either gram-negative rod, Enterobacteriaceae, or staph, something like that. So you'll have growth on one or the other place.
And then we also count it on the SPA?
No.
No.
You do not have to do that.
Okay.
The SPA is kind of a fallback plate because everything should grow on SPA. So what I want you to do is I want you to count the colonies on MAC, report them correctly, count the colonies on PEA, and you may not have colonies on both plates. But if you do, then count them separately. Okay, and then if you have greater than 100 colonies, you use the small loop, just report out greater than 10 to the 5th organisms. You don't have to count everything. And you can pretty much tell. You start counting a few, but and when they're all jammed together, you won't be able to count them. So that's probably the best thing you could do. Okay, now we're going to talk about this more on Wednesday also, but a general rule of thumb is if you have greater than 100,000, which is 10 to the 5th colony forming units per mil, or organisms per mil, that is indicative of an infection. You have that many. If you have less than 10,000, that's probably just contamination. By contamination, we mean normal flora from the skin area, the vaginal area, when collecting the sample. Not that you have contaminated the sample. If it's somewhere in between 10,000 and 100,000, then we need to evaluate that based on symptomology, symptoms of the patient, or criteria that the laboratory has, because that's somewhere in between this gray area. These are some situations where a patient can have a urinary tract infection with less than 10 to the 5th organisms. If they are already on microbial therapy, we know what that does. If it is a catheterized specimen, and sometimes lab will use the large loop if it's a catheterized specimen or a suprapubic aspiration because there shouldn't be any contaminants in there with those types of specimens, so we can use a larger loop. Childhood sometimes, concomitant pyuria. What does that mean? Concomitant pyuria. What does the word concomitant mean? There's a good word with, you can use in your conversations. It means pyuria along with organisms. What's pyuria? How do we determine pyuria? The leukocyte esterase test or seeing white blood cells on the gram stain. So that's probably the single best indication, other than the number of organisms, that we do in fact have an infection. Because if it's just contamination, you're not going to have significant white cells in there. Okay, if the patient does have symptoms, and again, we'll talk more about that on Wednesday, what the symptoms are, or if it's a yeast infection, you probably will not have this amount of organisms on a yeast infection, but you can tell yeast pretty readily from bacteria. Okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to have some knowns, And the knowns we're using are more of the Enterobacteriaceae because there's so many of them. And we haven't, everybody hasn't seen all of these, so we're going to use some knowns from Enterobacteriaceae. We've tried to make some different dilutions of these organisms so that we can get them back down to a count or a population that you can count more readily. But that's pretty hard to do, so sometimes it's just kind of a hit and miss thing. But what I want you to do for these two organisms, Serratia marcescens and Providencia stewardii, I want you to plate those using the small loop. So one of you in your pairs, you can do this in pairs, one of you will do a Serratia and the other one will do the Providencia. Okay, then we've got Ciprobacter fuindii and Enterobacter cloacae. And I want you to plate those using the large loop. Okay, so again, one of you in your pair does Serratia and Ciprobacter, for example. The other one does Providencia and Enterobacter. So that you do two unknowns, one with a large loop and one with a small loop. Okay, got it? And then plate them to blood MAC PEA. And today, because these are pure cultures, known organisms, pure cultures, we'll also do a TSI. So that on these, starting tomorrow then, based on the TSI reaction, you can use your flow diagram. Follow through the flow diagram that we used for the Enterobacteriaceae to identify these. Okay, for your unknown. Use the small loop, 0.001. Streak it onto blood MAC PEA. Do not streak for isolation. Streak using the urine plating technique. Okay, and we'll do a gram stain. Speak.
Sorry, I'm asking so many questions. So since you said that usually these are one colony, is it
one colony type? One organism type. No. Not one colony, one organism.
Cool.
Does that make a difference? Any questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So we don't know what's in here. There could be one organism, there could be two organisms. We don't know. I wouldn't just give you one, would I? Okay, use the small loop, streak blood, the MAC, PEA, and then do a gram stain. Now, the way we typically do a gram stain on urine is we use the large loop. So just take a drop of the urine using the large loop, put it on a slide. Don't add any water to the slide. Just put one drop using the large loop on the slide. Don't spread it out. Just leave it as the drop. Let it air dry. So that might take a little longer, so I would do that first. Get it on the slide, let it air dry while you're streaking everything else.
Do we have to change loops? Because our slides aren't sterile.
If you put it on the slide first, you're probably going to use a different loop because it's not sterile. So usually they would probably do this last, but do it first so it's got time to dry. Now, in the past, I have had students use an API. However, we're going to eliminate that. The reason is because APIs are getting too darn expensive to use them. So hopefully you remember how to do an API.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you because you weren't here that day or whatever. So you will do an API because you haven't done one yet. So nobody else does APIs. So hopefully you remember how to do them because on the final practical, you will have two APIs that you can use. You don't have to use them, but you can use them. So that's why I usually like to include another one here to give you another chance to practice, but we just have to cut some costs somewhere, so we're cutting out that extra API.
No, I
didn't
do it.
For the practical, can we use our API notes or the instructions that they set up?
Don't you have to memorize?
Just to double check.
Don't use our notes.
You can use your notes. On the final practical, you can use your notes.
On everything?
Yeah. On everything.
Okay.
I will explain more about final practical later, but you will be able to use your notes, your flow diagrams. Okay? So, no APIs this week. Well, okay, that's it. Any questions? This is a fun week. Remember, keep that Proverbs scripture in your mind.